Hey everyone, I'm Thanos Davelis, and welcome back to The Greek Current, a podcast by the Hellenic American Leadership Council and Kathimerini, where we highlight the top stories of the day every afternoon with analysis from guest experts, policymakers, journalists, and HELC staff. Hundreds of people gathered on Monday at Athens Cathedral to pay their final respects to Greek composer and politician Mikis Theodorakis, who was an integral part of the Greek political and musical scene for decades. Theodorakis passed away last week on Thursday at the age of 96. After his death was announced, Greece declared 3 days of national mourning, while tributes poured in from admirers of his work and legacy from across the world. Theodorakis' work ranges from rousing songs based on major Greek poetic works to operas, ballets, and film scores. Professor Gail Holst-Warhaft joins the Greek Current to explore the life and legacy of Mikis Theodorakis. Professor Gail Holst-Warhaft is a freelance writer and poet, a philhellene, a musician who has performed with Mikis Theodorakis, and the author of a number of books on Greek music, including Theodorakis, Myth and Politics in Modern Greek Music, and The House with the Scorpions, Selected Poems and Song Lyrics of Mikis Theodorakis. Gail, welcome on to the Greek Current. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be with you.
Gail, I'd like to begin with your personal experiences with Mikis Theodorakis. You knew him personally going back to the 1960s, and you've written a biography of him titled Theodorakis, Myth and Politics in Modern Greek Music. How did you first come to know and get involved with Mikis Theodorakis?
I knew about him in the 60s, but it really was 1972 when he came to Australia. I was in Greece when the coup happened and then went back to Australia and joined the Committee for the Restoration of Democracy in Greece. And it was in the house of one of the members that I heard a cassette he'd recorded secretly in Zatana, talking about his conditions of house arrest and how distressing it was for not only him, but for his children. So he was sort of a mythical figure to me already when he came to Australia on tour, and I went out with this group of Greeks to the airport. And when we got there, I was sort of pushed into the press room with him, and the Greek community had forgotten to bring an interpreter. And so his spoken English is not very good. So I was pushed to sit next to him and interpret, and I felt very inadequate. And also I was sort of shaking to be sitting so close to this man who seemed to me like some mythical creature. I knew his music so well, and I'd heard about his extraordinary dramatic life. So that was my first introduction to him. And I was living in Sydney. I went to his concerts there. And one night, before they left Australia, I invited them to my house for dinner. And he saw in my room a harpsichord. And he said, "You're a harpsichordist." And I said, "Yes, I play Baroque music." And, I said, "I play some of your music too." He said, "When the junta falls, you will play in my orchestra." And I thought this was some sort of joke. And I used to laugh at it and tell people, "I'm going to play with Theodorakis." But Theodorakis had a terrific memory. And when I went back to Greece and went to one of his first concerts after the restoration of democracy, I went back afterwards to congratulate him, and he said, "Oh, Gail," he said, "have you still got a harpsichord?" I said, "No." So he said, "Find one and you're in the orchestra." So somehow or other, I brought a harpsichord from London to Greece and joined the band, which was an extraordinary experience because these were the first tours he'd done of the eparchia, of the countryside, after the liberation. And people were just wild to see him and touch him. And it was one of the most exciting experiences I think I've ever had, because it was partly political in that he'd been a symbol of the resistance to the dictatorship. And it was musically, there was this thirst. I think Greeks were thirsty to hear those tunes that they had lived on during the 7 years of the dictatorship. They were just so thirsty to hear one of his songs. So that experience, to me, I always sort of think of it like being on tour with Che Guevara and Mick Jagger. It was the height of his popularity, both politically and musically, when I toured with him. So I had a few weeks of that experience. And, a year later or so, I played with him at Epidaurus, in the Epidaurus Festival, in an Aristophanes play that he'd done the music for.
Gail, I want to talk about his music. Despite the performance of his operas, symphonies, and songs in some of the major concert halls of the world, for most people outside of Greece, Theodorakis remains the composer who wrote the world-famous scores for the films Zorba, the film Z, and Serpico. His music, however, ranges from classical compositions to turning to the then low-class bouzouki to set music to poetry by major Greek poets that made him beloved in Greece. What can you tell us about his musical journey and his compositions?
Well, it's a most extraordinary and unusual journey that he made. He came from a family where nobody would have listened to Baszucki and nobody would have been familiar with Rebetika. He was educated in classical music, but he was also educated in church music. He joined the choir, and when his father was stationed in Tripoli, he actually began composing church-style Byzantine music. Not being a religious person, he was nevertheless very attracted to the music of the church. And then he got interested in becoming a musician and was accepted at the Athens Conservatory. But during that time, of course, it was one of the most turbulent times in Greece. We're talking about, first of all, the Italian occupation, which happened when he was a teenager, 14, 15 years old. And then the German occupation, which was, I think, one of the most terrible occupations of any country in Europe. More people died of starvation in Athens than in any other country except Poland during the winter of 1941-42. It was an absolutely cruel occupation. And so quite soon after the Germans took control, Greeks rose up and formed a resistance organization, which Theodorakis immediately joined as a very young man. So his life was transformed by that, as it was for many Greeks. And there's a sort of general feeling that that resistance was led by the communists. As it was, the most effective resistance to the Germans was led by the communist party. But people of all stripes who were patriots and who were angry about the occupation did join that. Now, during this time that he is completely involved with the resistance, at the same time, he is studying classical music and studying piano and violin and composition. And he is obviously a brilliant student with a lot of promise. And his musical studies are interrupted, but he goes on composing and writing classical music, not popular music. And when the war ends and the left loses the battle for Athens and so on, Theodorakis is imprisoned. He's sent then to various islands where he's in exile, Ikaria particularly, but then later to the terrible concentration camp of Makronisos, where he's very badly tortured. All this time, he's writing music, and people smuggle him little scraps of paper to write his first symphony. And it's the most amazing story, I think, of somebody who's so passionately wedded to his music that even under these conditions, he never stops composing. And after the civil war and his imprisonment and suffering, he, by this time, had become engaged and married his wife, Myrto. And the two of them went to Paris on scholarships. His wife was a radiologist, and she had a scholarship to study in Paris. And he went and studied with Messiaen, and he was extraordinarily successful very quickly in composing film scores for Ill Met by Moonlight was the first major commission he had, but he was also commissioned by Sadler's Wells to compose the music for the ballet Antigone. And he was, we're talking the 50s to 1960 nearly, during those years, he won a major musical award for which Shostakovich was the main judge in Russia. He had commissions from London, commissions from Hollywood for scores, and he could have remained, I think, a very successful modern composer without ever returning to compose popular songs, except that political events in Greece were so turbulent and he felt guilty to be, you know, safe in Paris while riots were going on in the streets of Athens that he began to think he should join in some way. And that was when Yanis Ritsos, the poet, sent him a series of poems called Epitaphios, which had been inspired by riots in the streets of Salonika by the tobacco workers. And a young man was killed in those riots, and his mother bent over the body on the street and lamented her son's loss. And that picture was published in a left-wing newspaper in Athens. And Ritsos, when he saw it, I think he saw it as a sort of pietà, like Mary over the body of Christ. It was a very iconic image, and he turned that into a long series of poems in the voice of the lamenting mother for the loss of her son. And he sent those poems to Paris, to Theodorakis, who immediately started setting it to music. And when he had finished, he thought, this is my country calling to me, and this is something I have to do. So he returned to Athens, having composed these songs, and decided what he wanted to do, having been in exile with people who were really moved by Rebetika music. would be to find a bouzouki player and a rebetika singer to perform them.
So this is when he makes that shift from classical music to a style that's closer to Greece's laiko or popular music.
That is the shift, epitaphios. There was such a scandal about it that there was a storm in the Greek press about it, and criticism from the left and the right. How can you mix the poetry of Yannis Ritsos, who was recognized as a major Greek poet and a composer, even though he was a leftist, of what was regarded as highbrow poetry, with the lowest of lowbrow music, which was the rebetika, the music of Piraeus and the lower classes, and music that was associated with hashish smoking and drugs and so on. And that mixture turned out to be a revolution in Greek music. It was something quite incredible. The bouzouki music that he used, which had themes from Byzantine music and from other things in it, folk music, but the use of Kiotis, who was one of the best bouzouki players of the day, and the wonderful Grigoris Bitikotsis, who was a nightclub singer and also wrote some good neo-rebetic songs, the use of those two musicians made this something that appealed to a very, very broad audience. And whatever the intellectuals said, the people just fell in love with this music. And people read poetry in Greece when I first went there. People read Seferis, they read Ritsos. It was as if, you know, working class people were reading T.S. Eliot. It was remarkable how many people enjoyed poetry.
So, Gail, you write in The Guardian that this decision to combine high art with low, such as, you know, the bouzouki and the rebetiko, as you just mentioned, it really caught the public imagination and it ushered in this new age of Greek music. He wasn't the only one who was doing this, though. There were other contemporaries like Manos Hadzidakis. What made Theodorakis really stand out from those other composers, like Manos Hadzidakis, and from composers of rebetiko and laiko music, which were incredibly popular then?
Hadzidakis never used bouzouki, and he didn't, even though he admired the rebetika, he thought of them as something that didn't mesh with high poetry. And when Theodorakis told him that he was going to use a bouzouki player and an actual bouzouki with this music, he said, "You've taken leave of your senses. Nobody, you know, no cultured person is going to listen to this music." Theodorakis said, "Well, you can have the songs. Go away and do whatever you want with them. I'm going to do my version and you do another version." So Hadzidakis made a recording with Nana Mouskouri and with guitar and piano and so on, and it became quite popular. But Theodorakis, meantime, had brought out this version with Bitikotsis and bouzouki that just completely blew it away, because it opened it up to a completely different audience. Manos Hadzidakis was a wonderful composer, but he always kept something more classical, something a little removed from low-class music. He didn't mix the genres in the same way. And the rebetika composers, or the neo-rebetic composers of Laika, Taraguri, as they were called, Tsitsanis and others, they wrote fabulous songs, but they weren't the same, mostly because of the lyrics. Theodorakis used the best poets of Greece, and he used poets that were outside Greece's borders, and combined them at first with fairly obvious rebetika influences. And later on, he began introducing, his whole idea was that he could begin with this pop music that was so catchy and so attractive, and he could add elements of the classical music he was working on. And he did that successfully, I think, in Axiones D. Axiones D was the poetry of Odysseus Elitis, the Nobel Prize winner. It's a remarkably difficult work if you listen to it, in that it has classical elements, it has Byzantine elements, it has pop songs as well, and yet it became extraordinarily popular with a very broad section of the Greek population.
So Theodorakis was deeply political, and as you pointed out in our discussion, you know, he had joined the resistance against the Nazi Germans and Italians at a young age. He became active in post-war politics in Greece. He was exiled and imprisoned, and he was an international symbol of resistance against the right-wing junta. Can you talk about Theodorakis as a politician? And also, can you talk about the inner relationship between his music and Greek society and politics?
Yes, he was a very controversial figure always, Theodorakis, and he was controversial in his music, he was controversial in his politics. His songs that were written before the junta took over in 1967, this was from the time he wrote Epitaphios. The 7 years between that and the dictatorship were years when music seemed to just pour out of him. He wrote one cycle of songs after another, one more beautiful than the next. He wrote Madhouse, and he wrote Yellow Sopizi. He wrote Epiphania, Epitaphios, all these wonderful cycles of music that nearly every Greek knows how to sing, and certainly the people of his generation, but also younger Greeks know these songs. And a lot of them were not political at all, but he was known to be a political figure and became a leading political figure after the murder of Grigoris Lambrakis. This was a big turning point in Greek society. The civil war had lasted until 49 or 50, however you like to count it. Nobody's quite firm about those dates. But during the 1950s, there was still tremendous persecution of the left in Greece. And in that time, the Communist Party had been banned, but the communists were represented, or the left-wing forces in Greek, by a party called the United Left. And Grigoris Lambrakis, who was a professor of medicine, and he also happened to be an Olympic athlete, a marathon runner, and very much, you know, a sort of attractive figure on the left, was a deputy in that party, and so was Theodorakis. And when Lambrakis was murdered on his way to give a speech in Salonika, because it was thought he would stir up the crowds on the left, the film Z is all about that murder. Theodorakis, with other friends of Lambrakis, formed an organization called the Lambrakis Youth Movement. And Theodorakis, as a leader of that movement, began to give concerts, which were seen to be a way of expression of the absolute horror of Lambrakis' death, but also a sort of declaration of freedom for former Civil War people who'd been on the left and for young people who wanted to express their resentment at the repression of anything on the left and at the enormous power of the army and of the royal family. So his concerts became sort of rallying places for the left and for young people who were just interested in freedom. It was a moment where Greeks were demanding freedom, and his concerts were so stirring that they were shut down, and every time they wanted to hire a hall to do one of his concerts, they were refused permission. And at one of the concerts, they actually flew Air Force jets above the stadium so that nobody could hear the music. So by 1967, when the coup d'etat happened, his music had become a sort of like a weapon. It was a sort of political weapon. And one of the most extraordinary things to me, and what made me, I think, turn into somebody who was prepared to play an active role in politics myself, politics of Greece, was the fact that they banned his music. You could be fined up to 6 months for even playing one of his songs in your house. You could be fined for singing his song on a public bus. You could be fined in your own house for singing one of his songs. So I thought any country that places that value on music must really like music. You have to be somehow invested in music to make that complete ban on somebody's music. Even his love songs and completely unpolitical works were banned. And yes, Theodorakis' music until that moment was really a big political weapon, and it went on being so in the big concerts he gave between his liberation. He was let out of Greece in 70, and from then to 74, he did concerts all over the world, and it was a way of trying to rally support for the restoration of democracy in Greece.
And of course, after the fall of the junta, as you mentioned early in our conversation, there were these politically charged concerts that took place with his return to Greece. How would you describe the legacy that he's left within Greece?
I don't think there's anybody in Greece who hasn't been touched in some way by Theodorakis, even if it's only a song they know, you know, Sto peri alito Christo, or some completely unpolitical song that they can't resist the tune of, even if they're right-wingers or anti-Theodorakis. Everybody has been touched by him. And I think even, again, people who were opposed to him admired his bravery, too. He faced torture, he faced exile, and he would never shut up. Even during the junta years after he'd been let out of prison, he went on trying to smuggle messages out about the conditions of political prisoners and so on. He had enormous courage, and he had enormous personality. He was larger than life. I mean, even physically, he was larger than life. He was 6'4" tall in a country where most men were probably around, you know, 5'8" or something. He was a giant, and it was a source of enormous embarrassment to him as a young man. But as a leader and as a conductor, it was impressive to have this man who was like a giant almost in front of the orchestra. His conducting was something also that touched people. It was amazing, the energy he had on the podium. It was like nothing I've ever seen. It was electrifying. His legacy, I think, will be first musical, then political, and then I think just in terms of personality, I think he'll be seen as perhaps the last of those great Greek heroes like Kazantzakis and so on, who seem to be larger than life in all sorts of ways. And, you know, it's not very fashionable nowadays to talk about heroes. Heroes are sort of a bit suspect, but he really was a hero, and he was a hero to many people. And he, I think, may have been somewhat naive in his belief that his songs could change the world or that Greece could be a leader in the movement for freedom. But it inspired him, and it inspired many other Greeks to follow him and to take his example.
And I read a few fascinating pieces, Gail, that highlighted how his music actually inspired people across the world, from Latin America to Afghanistan even. What do you think his international legacy is?
Well, I hope it's not Zorba. Zorba has come to bite him, you know. He often says he wished he'd never written it, because the Zorba theme, popular as it is and catchy as it is, has become such a cliche of what Greek music is all about. I hope he'll be remembered, I would say, wonderful and interesting as his classical works are. I think his real genius was setting Greek poetry to music and setting non-Greek poetry. I mean, his settings of Pablo Neruda or Lorca, they're wonderful settings. I think that will be, I think, the biggest legacy, is that this man was a musical genius who wrote more extraordinary melodies than just about any composer that I've ever heard of. And that seems to me will be the big legacy of him in the years to come. And I think his stature as somebody who stood up to oppression, stood up to fascism, stood up to occupation of his country and so on, I think that will be woven into it, just as it is with somebody like Pablo Neruda.
Gail, thank you for joining us on The Greek Current. It was great having this conversation with you about Mikis Theodorakis.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. And, you know, thank you for the work you do.
In other news, Greece has created its first ever ministerial post to exclusively handle the fallout from climate change in the wake of this summer's devastating wildfires, and it's bringing in a former EU crisis manager expert for the role. Christos Stylianides, previously the EU Commissioner for Humanitarian Aid and Crisis Management, was announced on Monday as Greece's Climate Crisis and Civil Protection Minister. The appointment highlights how climate change challenges have vastly expanded for governments in recent years, stretching beyond efforts to cut emissions to also include handling more severe events such as floods and wildfires. Stylianides, a Cypriot national, will be awarded Greek citizenship before being sworn in on Friday. Finally, Greece has begun administering vaccinations for COVID-19 outside churches in a pilot program recently announced by the government as a means of encouraging more people to get the shots. The government announced the program last month, with mobile healthcare units to administer shots in town squares outside churches, initially in Crete and later expanding to the country's main cities. Authorities have been seeking to boost Greece's vaccination drive with a series of incentives and have sought the support of the country's powerful Orthodox Church. Meanwhile, government spokesman Yannis Economou on Tuesday indicated that school teachers and clerics may be next in line after health workers for mandatory vaccinations. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.